This episode is brought to you by the On Up movement, a massively important stand against financial stress and for financial confidence. Why? Because the number one cause of stress in America is money, and I recommend you join the On Up movement to help people and yourself become financially literate. The movement is sponsored by SunTrust Bank, but this is not about them selling services. Rather, it's about dealing with this issue. No, the On Up movement is not about big changes that you need to take in your life. It's really about taking simple steps to get you on track, to understand how to manage your money, how to make budgets, how to understand financial literacy. On Up has exploded in popularity in the last few months, and I recommend you go to onup.com, take the mental wealth quiz. It takes about 2 to 5 minutes, and they'll show you for free what you know and what you don't about dealing with financial situations and the simple steps you can take. The mental wealth quiz is smart, it's fun, try it, run with it, do it yourself. Here's what happens. It automates responses that lets you understand your financial literacy and what you can do to improve it.
Welcome to Uprising. Each episode looks inside what it takes to lead the most dynamic and successful cultural movements. Some of them in the business world, some in the social realm, some in politics, and some in between, to see why people start uprisings, what gives those initiatives momentum and keeps them going, and most important, what lessons can you learn from these movements and how to apply them to your business and even personal life. Let's explore the secret to sparking movements that move people into action.
Passionate ideas.
Controversial ideas.
Uprising ideas.
The power is now in the hands of anyone.
To start a cultural movement.
Your movement.
To move the world.
Let's start this episode of Uprising by asking you to connect to the internet. Now, I know this is a request that probably feels a lot like being asked to breathe. It's not something you've probably thought about a lot lately, but go ahead. Just do it. Okay, you're connected. Now feel that. Are you experiencing something magical? You're feeling great. Strong sense of happiness in this wonderful playground for learning and laughing. It's addictive, highly addictive. Perhaps, actually, some people say it's enthralling. It lets you connect with people who see the world as you see the world. This is what the internet has become, from art to commerce and everything in between. It's this beautiful thing to open your eyes, to make your world bigger, break down barriers, smash open windows, bring you to Mars. Fill your heart and mind with all that is happening on the internet. Oh, what a great movement of humanity. Perhaps the greatest movement ever. And that's a conversation I'm having today with our guest, Virginia Heffernan, a New York Times columnist about culture and new media, and most recently the author of an outstanding new book called Magic and Loss. I love her writing. It's so inspiring, so I hope you'll join us for this conversation. So, to start the show, is the internet a mass outpouring of random content, or actually a coordinated movement?
I think coordinated movement sounds like politics to me. Part of talking about the internet is settling on a metaphor for it. And I think both of the things you said, well, random outpouring of content, it sounds like we're first treating the internet as like the media, right? Like a channel for content. And in that way, we've already distinguished ourselves from the people who see the internet as a weapon or a place or a game. So let's just start by saying, you know, if we're already agreeing to a metaphor, and the metaphor I choose is that it's a work of art, a collective work of art. And so in some ways, if it's a collective work of art, it doesn't really matter. YouTube is my real touchstone for this. I thought when YouTube appeared that as a TV critic, I might publish reviews in the New York Times of individual pieces of internet television, and that sooner or later nytimes.com could host all the quote television that ever appeared on the internet, because I was sure it would be a very limited supply. Then I saw YouTube, and it was as though all of us had been waiting our whole lives to upload clips of video to the internet. Where did all this stuff come from? It was more like we were all unearthing this civilization that had existed somehow and had been almost, you know, it gets a little spooky, but almost pre-digitized. Like people, it was already anticipating being uploaded and consumed in the way of YouTube. So in that way, it's very different from other arts that start, you know, I think I say punk music or color field painting begins in a certain place and then expands outward. It doesn't seem to come fully formed in huge numbers. You know, you could count the number of punk songs at one point, and then there were more and more and more. Somehow with YouTube, it seemed like there was were never fewer than a million videos accessible on YouTube.
Virginia, I just want to ask, who were the first users of YouTube?
They're some of the first users of YouTube, and I hope I'm not distracting from your question, but some of the first users of YouTube were old radar and sonar fans. There was a geriatric 1929 was like, a lot of people call him OG YouTube. He'd been waiting since the war to have a means of communication that was this quick and that used video. He wasn't like all that literate, so he didn't want to type in text. He wanted just to be able to speak about his experiences. As soon as he saw YouTube, he hadn't even been using the internet. He was like, this is what I've been waiting for since I first was an engineer in the Second World War.
How are we humans influenced by the internet?
A lot of us are influenced in the way we use and think about the internet by the way we first came to it. So the way you first beheld the internet, if you were using it at work for Excel sheets, if you were using it for gaming, if you were using it to read the New York Times, if you're using it to code, you have a whole different metaphor set to talk about this thing.
So how did you first come to experience the internet?
I grew up in the town where Dartmouth College is, Hanover, New Hampshire, colonial town. We were obsessed with the colonies and the fact that we'd been a colonial town. And the president of the college had mostly been someone, you know, hospitable to the football team and so on. But all of a sudden in the 70s, the school decided to raise its intellectual profile, and they invited in Einstein's assistant, John Kemeny, who was also the author of the computer language BASIC, to come be the president of the college. He had big ideas for our town, and the first one was that we would have an ARPANET-era mainframe computer in the middle of town. You know, one of those like rhinoceros computers that has plexiglass, bulletproof all around it. And he had to make a deal with the town, this town that was like, we weren't even like, people weren't even entirely pro electricity then. Like, we were using wood stoves, and like, there was a lot of back to the landism. So the agreement he made with the town was that he would give the local school children a lesson in computer coding, computer programming.
And that was the deal with the town.
It was a deal with the town so that he could have the real estate to build this Kiewit computing center with the mainframe. We called it just the computer in those days. I then wanted to take it home with me. Like, the place closed at night, and I wanted to get access to it at home. So the sysprox showed me how, like, with a computer and a coupler.
With a phone,
you could mash it in to a coupler. It would make the, you know.
How did you describe that in the book? I remember there was, like, some funny language around the sound.
Oh, yeah, like squeal and crash.
Yeah, squeal and crash. Yeah.
You know, do you want to do an impression of it since we're in audio? Can you do it?
Something like that.
Exactly. So I loved that signal, that sound. It just sounded like all the information in the world crashing together. And I persuaded my parents to buy a coupler and the so-called dumb terminal that became intelligent once you hooked it to, it's a little like a Chromebook, you know, it doesn't know anything intrinsically, but if it hooks up to, in this case, the mainframe or with the Chromebook, the cloud, you get all this power. But I couldn't just practice BASIC on it. I needed to connect to the sysprog so they could sort of show me around. And a couple of things, they showed me some games that were interesting and had Easter eggs. The beginning of thinking, like, a lot of, I didn't become a hacker, obviously, but a lot of hackers were like, oh, cheating is gameplay, you know? Easter eggs are, you know, if I know this code and that makes me win, that's as good as winning the old-fashioned way.
Right.
I didn't come quite to that realization, but I was like, and you may have felt this too, all these incredible workarounds for things that felt like they would take so much friction in the real world and access that I wouldn't have had as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old. Suddenly were accessible to me. Like, I could get, like, the library's card catalog, you know, a bunch of things that, like, you know, would have taken days to work out were suddenly at my fingertips. Not to, and then all these things socially that weren't available were at my fingertips. So like, you know, on the internet, no one knows you're a 10-year-old girl. I could go on to what eventually amounted to a chat room and talk about subjects that interested me without anyone like elbowing me out of the conversation.
So you must have stumbled into a few chats that made you blush, probably prepared you really well for the life of a journalist in New York City.
You're just like, how can I get a piece of this conversation? And right. It's fascinating. So that I was in a remote place. I was a girl. I had a quiet voice. I wasn't, you know, I was socially awkward because I was a preteen, a number of other reasons. And all of a sudden I could be Athena, not Virginia Heffernan. That's like awkward name for a kid, but Athena. Right. On the computer.
The goddess of war or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And I could talk about Led Zeppelin as if I knew something or Reaganomics and compel people to listen to me. And if they were ignoring me, I didn't see it.
It seems like the internet can bring you a lot of joy.
I came up with my avatar on day one, Athena, and it became a massively multiplayer online role-playing game in a matter of probably 15 minutes after I had logged on to this first chat room.
Wow.
And there was no question to me then and now that that's what we're doing here. I mean, we're playing roles, we're playing a game with roles, and we're, you know, piloting away awkwardly, each of us, but more than 3 billion of us, through all these new tools that allow us to make very traditional things, images, words, music, film, and design.
If you go back to my first question about, you know, just a random outpouring of content or this coordinated movement. And we talk about movements here because this is a show about uprisings and movements.
Okay.
But if you think about just the innate human, I don't know, nature, our desire for the most part to connect with other human beings, to improve our mind, to improve our environment.
Yeah.
In a way, even though we may not be thinking about it, maybe there's like an, just like there was an, at some point, someone who says, well, maybe we should have a document that charts out, you know, the rights of man. Or just like, you know, like those things were obviously innate as well. We can't keep killing each other. So we need something that, you know, so maybe in that respect, it is a coordinated movement, even though it's not, you know, something that we're aware of. It's just intuitive, right?
You know, it's sort of the web with the Jewish progressivism at work at Google. With the Zen, you know, vaguely fascist, design of Apple, with some of the Christian companies in Texas that ended up, you know, getting a stronghold there like Compaq. These kind of idealists managed to transform the internet from a military project to a project of civilization and trade. You know, it's not an accident that early on in the 80s, later in the 80s, we started, in 90s, we started... Russians suddenly started doing like the back end and the coding for a ton of companies, that like there was a way that we were using the same kind of technical skills and the same kind of aggression about an arms war, but now around fleshing out the internet eventually for commerce. Anyway, the long and short of it is are things getting more, are things getting more or less beautiful?
Is the internet enhancing or diluting the quality of creative and artistic output?
It's interesting because you start with the idea of like this incredible heterogeneity on something like YouTube or Flickr.
Yep.
But very quickly, and Instagram is a great example of this, very quickly it like tunnels into a kind of a slightly rote pattern style, and you have to start looking for more interesting things elsewhere. I should say this, and this is why I balk at the idea that like, oh, I wish it could all look like Medium or The Guardian online or like perfect Swedish, you know, egg chair or whatever. When you think, why doesn't everything look like this? On the other hand, there are certain exigencies that make sure things don't look like that on the internet, namely that it has to be very, very, very brutally inclusive.
What are the beneficial sides of the internet?
It's interesting to me how much parents looking at their children, looking at screens, what happens in that interaction where you say like, this can't be good for them. In the early days of television, the spectacle of a kid watching TV had the opposite effect on their mothers. It wasn't like, oh no, this is brain damage. You know, it literally was, I cannot believe I can stop my kid from getting hurt without putting them in shackles. And so it was like, this is the best thing ever happened to kids' health. They're sitting and laughing at howdy doody and how bad can that be? And they're not like, you know, breaking their ankle in the creek or dying. One of the things we fault kids who do screens a lot for is like not, quote, paying attention, because they're not paying attention to us. I was on the subway platform the other day and people were using their phones and I was looking at them. One, the woman in front of me was reading the Quran on her phone. Somebody else was playing a game. Somebody else looked like they were texting or chatting. You know, the subway thing, they all looked kind of amused and engaged. So slightly in a perverse way, I put that on Facebook, like how moving it is to see all these people in their mental spaces, because you hear so much of how awful it is that everyone's looking down at their phones. And now you can be reading the, you know, you can call up the beautiful Quran with one finger and you can do all these other things. And someone came in, rolled in on my Facebook post and said, well, he remembers the 60s and 70s in New York and how great it was because you could like pick up a woman on the subway and like, you know, make stolen glances with her across the track and then you could meet her and it was sexual and it was exciting. It was bodies in space. And I sort of thought, yeah, you know, I bet for the woman reading the Quran, she's pretty happy that that's not happening. Yeah, really.
Love this conversation, Virginia. I mean, choosing to think positive about the internet instead of choosing to think negatively, that's so great.
One of the things that's beneficial is, let's take Facebook birthdays. Birthdays are like kind of difficult in regular social space. It's confusing, you know, people, executives used to have to keep track of all their clients'
right.
birthdays.
Yeah.
Secretaries would keep track of them. And for the person having the birthday, on the one hand, you want everyone to know and wish you happy birthday. On the other hand, you don't want to tell anyone. Wishing someone a happy birthday costs you almost nothing. It costs you exactly as much as like it should cost to acknowledge like the fact that a friend of a friend has survived another day on this planet. And for them, it makes them feel like noticed and cared about. And it's just like this tiny feature of Facebook that solves this problem, you know? And it's hard to see why that's a bad thing. But that is just a tiny detail in all the ways that Facebook, as a juggernaut of our social lives, makes just acknowledging the existence of other people possible. So the first thing would be the degree of connectivity on a very simple level
right.
that is really hard to argue. And you have to like right. really try to find a cynical, you know, component to that.
This social media is really a way of maintaining close, you know, proximity to friends who are spread out today. To me, it's like this amazing experience where you can, the world has become so small.
At the same time, if it's very important to you that you're like only getting the facts and that you really hate seeing a picture of someone who's had, you know, that's photoshopped because you feel deceived that they look younger than they really are, then you know, then Facebook and social networking is probably not for you. The same way that I like reading Tolkien or I like reading Donna Tartt or I like reading,
You're talking like a Jungian, you know, you're talking like we all create these facsimiles
Absolutely.
Of ourselves anyway, these characters that don't really reflect our soul and so forth.
I don't feel deceived. I'll put it that way. Like you probably are not like, oh, Virginia's a big liar because she doesn't really have blonde hair. Like on the other hand, if you are, then it's probably not like social space might be anxiety provoking to you.
I think someone once said Google can bring you back 100,000 answers, but a librarian can bring you back the right one. So what are the good things?
So the first thing is this kind of connection that I do think has the moral advantage of sparking compassion and sparking sympathy and sparking kinship, you know, a feeling of kinship. Something that was incredibly moving, it's not as the fireworks are kind of internal, but I'd always had this like really guilty, buried feeling about having once in my life punched someone on the playground in the stomach when I was a child.
Wow.
And it was really because I was losing a game and she was winning. So like there was nothing, it wasn't like she had said something racist and I was doing something noble. It was just because I wanted the winning server square in Foursquare and she took it. So I was like, I'm mad at you. And I remembered it as happening in this particular way. So, and the friend, I always have been like around her, like, oh, she saw this monster in me, you know? And so like every time her name would come up on Facebook, I'd be like, oh, that's someone that knows this monster in me. All right. So a different friend got in touch with me on Facebook and she said, remember our you know, blah, 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 our childhood, and we were talking and having a nice time. And then she said, you know, I've always been so sorry about what happened on the playground that one time. And I said, oh, you mean when I hit this other friend? And she said, no, you hit me. And I said, what? I remember it so differently. And she said, yes, I like pushed you out of the server square and said, F, I swore at you. We were like, you know, 8 years old. And I had it coming. You hauled off and hit me in the stomach. So I'm not sure what happened, except that I now remember that experience with much less crushing guilt. And we actually had this reconciliation that we would never have staged in person. It was too buried, you know? I never would have called her up 30 years later or, you know, 35 years later and said, let's sit down and talk about this moment. But the moment was like one of those things that I would wake up in the middle of the night like,
think about
something wrong with me? Why can't I lose? I've got to learn, you know? And this was like, you know, we were in Facebook chat and we were sitting there. She's in Australia, you know, or New Zealand.
Right.
And, and both of us were like, I have to admit, I'm crying now. You know, I'm wow. crying thinking about it. And I just am sure that if I hadn't been on Facebook at, you know, and I hadn't seen a messenger thing come up from someone I didn't know that well, I wouldn't have had that conversation. There's been a lot of like moral healing and setting the record straight around things that happened years and years ago. You know, like when an ex-girlfriend out of nowhere friends you on Facebook,
I
like
know,
someone
yeah.
that you think you would have ignored at a party because there was so much pain. And all of a sudden, she's married, you're married, there's kids, and she's just like, hey, so-and-so wants to be friends on Facebook. And you're just like, wow, that chapter has now been, you know, we're like humans in the world together again. The second thing, which is related, which I just brought up, is that it makes all of us, this self-invention that goes on online that can be disturbing to some people is interesting to people who like characters, who like fantasy, who like binge-watching, like Downton Abbey.
Right,
you know,
right,
like,
yeah.
Is Mary really this, you know, kind of perfect person? Or is she this, you know, is someone else on Downton Abbey? Well, I like the little gap between who you are and who you present yourself. But another paradoxical thing that's come out of it, and I think you and I have this in common, is a renewed appreciation for life offline. So there's nothing like living in the clouds of the internet to make the real world seems so extraordinarily beautiful and trippy. I just read this thing about treating people who are addicted to their phones, looking at this boring, this much space, I'm holding up my hand to signal the iPhone screen, this much space with the apps and so on, which we see all the time. We live in that universe. They were trying to get people addicted to that interface off it. They gave them a little subcutaneous LSD, a tiny dose, and suddenly the people couldn't care less about their phones because the faces of people on the bus were so freaking bad. How great, right?
And that is so funny.
Like, you can do that. We're not so weak that we need the LSD to do that. Like, it is really, really interesting to look out the window.
Ah, so a consensual hallucination experienced by you and me and billions of other people in every nation on the planet. That's great.
It's more interesting because I do it so infrequently. You know, the fact that you get to look at other human faces during the day is a privilege. You know, it's like the way that listening to vinyl or going to live concerts became an incredible privilege after MP3s. If you really have a choice, people would rather have vinyl or live concerts. I mean, this idea that the Rolling Stones make more on vinyl and touring, they make $1 billion a year now as they're like ready for the retirement home than they did in the heydays of their careers. I think that's an epiphenomenon of the internet. It's just like, get me away from this thing.
So the internet enhances our real experiences, doubles down on our genuinely sensory perception. But what about the dark side? Isn't the internet also subversive?
First of all, you never know where power is and it never works perfectly. So let's say that Google has managed to create this like incredible surveillance machine in concert with Facebook to get us to keep one identity with our real name so that we can find our purchase record. It has one credit card attached to it. Our purchase records exist so that there's enough data to find out that like I'm going to be interested in this Madewell shirt that I was checking out on, and people do this thing that you probably know more about than I do, like consumer relation management or whatever, that like horrible dark arts of following you everywhere you go and knowing where you've been and so on.
Okay. I love how marketing is becoming the dark side. I suppose we have a lot to answer for.
Even that is subvertible by the individual, you know, and also very inefficient ultimately. Like, it's not that bad that the Madewell shirt that I left in my cart comes up to follow me around. I either want it or I don't. And if I don't, I have a way of not buying it. Right. You know, but knowing those limits are part of your self-creation. They're part of your you know, obligation in digital space to sort of sort that out. I think we can have some faith in this thing that we've created, but we are also in a, like, currently I think we're in a renaissance period. There may be a dark ages to come. There always has been. But it's worth enjoying this current period of renaissance. There's so many upsides to it. And the strange unwillingness to acknowledge those upsides and the almost like Javert-like obsessive desire to say that the internet in some vocabulary or another is bad for us and unhealthy for us, you know, even as 3 billion of us plus seem determined to stay on it and keep using it, seems like a species of like self-hatred and self-disgust that I just can't countenance.
Okay, so here's another question. Does the internet make it easier to be a woman today or harder?
My approach to feminism comes from these like writers of the 60s and 70s, but I also think in a later version of feminism, it's been good. That feminist consciousness, to the extent that it's like marginalized, that it's like the like there's been a central language that's rational and hegemonic, and then there's a peripheral language that's like emotional and slippery and nonlinear, and like the whole women are irrational, that plays really well on the internet. It syncs with the internet. It's a new kind of speech that's come up, which is the person who's bothered by that or offended by that is now able to speak. So it's like a proliferation of speech. So that person is allowed to say she's offended when you say, you know, she used to have to like keep quiet about it, you know, or the person who, you know, I made this like, to me, very difficult to spot mistake where in something I wrote that read as racist to someone who read it. I was quoting a tweet, and the tweet itself seemed to contain some racist elements, but it was racist. It was like a whistle, a frequency that I didn't hear right. Until people pushed back on me on Twitter. And that was that a curve on my free speech, or was that a welcome? You know, I'm a New York Times journalist. They were allowed to say back to me on Twitter this thing that I never would have gotten, this right. Little note in this thing that made me suddenly aware of a whole universe. And they like completely schooled me wow. On it, you know, till I finally had to be like, you're absolutely right. I never understood that.
Wow.
And is that, does that mean less freedom on the internet? Maybe less freedom for me because it's horrible to be called a racist, or it feels like less freedom to me, but actually I was allowed to publish what I want in a mainstream thing. And then 20, 50 people were allowed to tell me where I got this detail wrong, where I got this nuance wrong. That sounds like freedom to me. And it also it sounds like freedom from the margins. So freedom from women, freedom for minorities that haven't been allowed to speak in public fora with the same amount of authority. And now they can.
The book, Magic and Loss, what motivated you to write it? What was the sort of... What was the thinking behind it? I mean, it's a wonderful read.
The thing that inspired me to write the book is I felt like I wanted to say, what if we imagined that this was a creative process and not a diseased process? Just what would that look like? And so the book is, you know, an effort to do that. At the same time, I'm not a Bolshevik for the digital revolution. The word loss is in the title for a reason. You know, I think MP3 compression lost a lot of something in music that made music important and resonant to me. And trying to take the measure of that loss and fully grieve for the experiences that I miss, you know, I started to like use a compass again because, one, I'm perpetually disoriented. And two, I think living in the satellite via GPS is like disorienting me further. So I want to use a compass that like connects to the poles of the earth, magnets. Like how crazy that there's analog technology that can like, you know, put
it's not, a it's not accurate, course. You know.
The analog, actual yeah. The analog
it's off a little bit. Just a little bit.
It's off a little bit?
Just a little
really?
Bit. Yeah.
Well that's cool. I mean look, why do you even know that?
Just a teeny bit. You know.
I gotta say, I anyone I've told this to says, why don't you just use the one on your phone? Where I'm just like, that's the point,
exactly.
But so, you know, I do feel like I've lost a lot of things. I realized, like, without a date book in my life and without, a few other, if I was going to do everything on mobile pay, I just would miss having leather, like just tanned leather in my life.
You can be happy that last year was the biggest year for pencils ever.
Yes.
So it's not disappearing.
I love this stuff. I know. Yeah. It was preservationism first, and you thought like, oh, these nostalgics are just like, oh, I'm going to be sure penmanship survives. But then there was like a physical longing for like the motor memory of sharpening a pencil or just the physical. And that's like another like beautiful way that culture expresses itself in that constant dialectic, like abstraction, earth. It's like Plato and Aristotle. You know, Plato points up. And that's beautiful abstraction. And Aristotle's like, the truth is right here.
Virginia, I just have to say, you are one of the most inspiring writers that I've read in a long time. And just the way you think about the internet makes me feel great, actually. And most people talk about the internet as being this sort of dangerous, subversive place. But when I read your words, actually, just reminds me about the potential.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's a great show, and it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you as well.
Thank you for joining our uprising today and listening to our show. If you missed the show, or if you want to find out more about who was on, or if you want to learn more about how to create your own uprising, please go to uprisingmovements.com. You can also download this uprising program from iTunes. Uprising was produced by Nicola Keneally and Adam Helen, with special help from Melanie Boardman, Karin Drakenberg, Philippa Freeman, Brianna Campbell, Fashad Faroudi, Mark Bruzzi, Will Isom, James Politi, and Jonathan Weeks. My name is Scott Goodson, and you've been listening to Uprising, what we can learn about movements and uprisings that are shaping our world in business, in society, and in between. For more on cultural movements and movement marketing, be sure to pick up a copy of the best-selling book Uprising, How to Build a Brand and Change the World by Sparking Cultural Movements, available on Amazon.com. Music for Uprising composed by Charles Duchateau.